Technology Committee, and we're going to vary the schedule briefly. We're going to start, I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 875, and we'll have some public testimony, and I'll close the public hearing and come back to it later because Representative Greenlick, would you please come up, and Dr. Goldberg, would you come up? Both of you are on a time crunch. So would you
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 875, as it was printed, directed the Department of Administrative Services to adopt a preferred drug list for state agencies directly or indirectly purchasing prescription drugs. However, we have the -8 amendment, which replaces the original measure, and it establishes a prescription drug purchasing program in DAS to purchase drugs, to receive discounted prices and rebates, and make those drugs available at the lowest possible cost. It requires DAS to appoint an administrator for this Oregon prescription drug program, and the pool of people included in that program may include PEB, OHSU, local governments and special districts, enrollees in the Senior Prescription Drug Assistance Program, and residents of Oregon 55 and over who meet certain other qualifications. However, the Oregon Health Plan patients are not included in the pool. This would require annual application by the participants and requires the department to issue an identification card. It requires the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research to develop and recommend an evidence-based preferred drug list. It requires report on implementation of this program to the appropriate interim legislative committee. And it would repeal rules adopted by the department to implement the program unless they are approved by the next legislative assembly.
Okay, thank you. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Mitch Greenlick from House District 33, and I'm very happy to be here on behalf of a large group of people that have been working on this measure for some time. You have in front of you the draft, the -8 amendments, which shows how many times we've had meetings on it and agreements or apparent agreements and a variety of things. I think we've reached a point where it's fair to say most of my colleagues that have been working on this from the beginning have come to the conclusion that we have a bill here that, if implemented, would provide a start, but most of us would agree it's far from an ideal solution, although we all have different ideas about what the ideal is. This represents perhaps the intersection among a set of ideas of how to get the process out, get it tried, do it in a safe and sane way that brings it back to the 73rd Legislative Assembly to review how things have gone. The participants that have been working on it and have a varying degree support of where we are, all at least a little bit positive, include Pharma, the Oregon Pharmacists Association, the FL-CIO, the SEIU, a variety of other folks from the governor's office and other places in the administration, and several reps and senators who've had some very specific interest. The model that the -7s present include, as the committee administrator said, a beginning process. It includes the potential for building a bulk purchasing -8s. Excuse me. It's good to have a mentor around to help a struggling freshman in this process, Senator Menace. Include the ability to try out the development in DAS of a bulk purchasing program that would include, as the administrator said, the potential for various state agencies, various local governments, various special districts, and a subset of the population without who have not had prescription coverage at least over the last 6 months, who are 55 years in older and older and have an income of under 185% of the poverty level. So I think we've tied up almost all the loose ends. There are a few wording things we may want to talk about in some subsequent committee, but we hope you'll move this out today.
Thank you. Questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a question. I'm not sure Representative Greenlee is the one to answer, but I'll ask it. Representative, what about the residents who are 54 years and younger? Why weren't those included? Why did you choose 54 as the cutoff point?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, it was a part of a process that started on with two polar opposites. One set of positions at the beginning of the process was this ought to be only for state agencies and other governmental and quasi-governmental agencies. The other end of the spectrum was that we ought to try it including everybody without health insurance and even a variety of health insurance kinds of organizations. And as we negotiated the process, we came to the conclusion that we weren't going to get consensus on this because the positions were so far apart, so we kept moving in the negotiations, the dash fours, the dash sevens, down to the dash eights. On the one set of groups pushing for expanding, the other set of groups pushing for contracting, and we were at the dash four and seven amendments at 65 and older, or maybe the fours, and then we moved down one step. This still represents a fairly large population, and we thought as a trial. Now, what also is in the legislation and has been from the beginning is the concept that the administrator of this program will write at the end of the two-year period for the 73rd Legislative Assembly a report on the feasibility of expanding it and a model for possibly expanding it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Senator Minnis.
But in addition to what Representative Greenlee mentioned, this population was modeled after the senior prescription drug package from the 2001 legislative session, and originally as we were migrating through the discussions, it had an asset test ascribed to it. So there were some machinations that brought the age down but still had an asset test, and I think where we landed was to do the age 54 but without the asset test, which expands the population. You still have to be, I think, under 185% of federal poverty level, but you don't have to have the asset test. So that's kind of an important point, that it does expand the population. But the underlying issue, I think, that this group found was that there was a desire to try to put together a process by which you could articulate how a bulk purchasing program would work or could work. And the inherent difficulties are found in the fact that most programs, like PEB already has bulk purchasing prescription drug packages inherent in the plans that they now provide for state employees. So there are contract issues. You can't get, for instance, PEB to just immediately join in the program because suddenly you upset the entire context and nature of the contracts that they have currently existing. Mm-hmm. So it's that complexity that really needs to be resolved. And so you have other populations here like self-insured municipalities, for instance, that may have an interest inherent in being part of the program just simply because they're probably more flexible than some of the other groups. It turned out to be an extremely complex discussion. And I guess from my perspective, I want to compliment Representative Greenlee and Dr. Goldberg and even the AFL-CIO for having spent a great deal of time arguing vehemently their positions and then ending up with a product that I think in the future will demonstrate that you can do the bulk purchasing and it can actually work and how it can work. Sounds like a political speech, but I think it's really kind of an underlying truth that we all found.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I think Representative Greenlee made a good point when he said this bill is an intersection among a set of ideas, and this is really a start to what we could have in the future. And as you were just saying, Representative, there's going to be a report prepared for the next Legislative Assembly to tell us how effective the program is and how we could expand it if we're interested in doing so. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that is correct. We expect at the end of 2 years it's still going to be a very primitive instrument, and we probably won't have very much more than a preliminary report at that time and may want to then push it another 2 years or change it based on what the experience has been. But yes, that is exactly it.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Goldberg.
For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here. We began this discussion, I believe, Representative Greenlick and I were sitting here a couple of months ago and talking about the issues that there were currently 450,000 people in the state who were uninsured and probably another 400,000 who were either underinsured or didn't have as part of their insurance access to prescription drug coverage, such as individuals who are covered under Medicare, which doesn't have a prescription drug benefit. And as a result of those discussions, we began a process as to how we could work together as a state to pool purchasing power and begin to help provide the sort of discounted prescription drugs that would make drugs affordable to people who need them. And here we are today, a couple of months later, and a number of meetings with the opportunity to move something forward, which is indeed taking what is an extremely complex area, how drugs are purchased, and the complexities of the pharmaceutical market have taken me a number of years to understand, and I'm not sure I totally understand it yet myself. And so we're all learning, and we've taken a complex area and are embarking upon what I believe is the first step at setting up a model that hopefully will be successful and that we can build on up as a state in the future. One last point, just to address, I think Senator Walker's point. In addition to what Representative Greenlick indicated, one other reason to look at certainly those above 54 as opposed to those below 54, if you're going to use age as a way to come up with a manageable population that we could start with so you can begin a program with your arms around it, is to look at a population which probably has the highest prescription drug need. And as we grow older, unfortunately, so do our bodies, and that the need for prescription drug coverage tends to be greater in a population-wise in those above 54, and that's one of the reasons as well.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. I'll go ahead and recess the public hearing, and we'll come back to that later. And we will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2987A. Are you going to read anything about it? Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2987, as it came to us, permits carriers to impose waivers of coverage for one or more pre-existing conditions for limited time periods for individuals accepted for individual health benefit plan coverage and various other details. However, I want to point out that this does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. You do have the Dash A6 amendments that I'm sure Glenn Hagen would be willing to summarize for you.
Better. Do you want to introduce yourself,
yes,
please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leonard Hagen. I'm with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I appreciate that this bill has been scheduled for a hearing and the opportunity to testify in support of the bill. With me is John Powell, also our lobbyist for Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, and Sue Cole, who is our manager of individual and small group underwriting. Regents, along with other health plans, has become increasingly concerned over the last few years with the declining enrollment in the small group and the individual markets. What happens in these insured private sector markets, as premiums go up, the individuals and employees or employers of these small groups as they go up, those individuals that lead the need the coverage the least tend to be the first to leave. So your low-risk individuals leave these markets. The high-risk individuals stay in the markets. And what that does is it creates an unstable market because you have to increase premiums to sustain the level of risk in those groups. Because of these concerns over the last 5 months, we've worked fairly extensively with DCBS, with insurance agents, with employers. And with the other health plans. I think I noticed you were looking for the handout and maybe where I'm at in the handout. I'm still on page one. We worked with these various groups to really come to three components of the bill that I'll walk through with you after I explain a little more about our small group market. But the three components, in the individual market, there's the waiver. In the group market, there's the rate band and the participation credit. And I'll talk about those three components in a minute. Going to page two, just really to show the market movement over the last 4 years, you can see in slide four the individual market. In the last 4 years, we've had a 10% decline in enrollment. Going over to page three, in the small employer market or the small group market, enrollment has declined by 15%. This is concerning to us because, as you probably are aware, we really have in the private insurance market is an employer-driven system. In slide six, you can see that 70% of Oregonians that are under 64 receive insurance coverage from their employer. 97% of large employers offer insurance. However, 55% of all employers offer insurance and less than 50% of small employers. As far as employers are concerned, things don't look better in the future. We're concerned that recent surveys, including one Mercer report, came out and is showing 15 to 18% increases, premium increases, for employers in 2003, and we expect double-digit increases over the next several years. You've heard me testify in previous committees what happens when premiums increase. For every 1% premium increase, over 3,700 Oregonians lose coverage altogether, their insurance coverage. And that brings us to the uninsured population. There are several slides here giving you some background information that I won't go into on what that uninsured pool looks like. The key point that I want to make for you today is that when you look at the national data and for Oregon, what it shows is the insurance pool doesn't just consist of individuals that can't get insurance. It consists of many working families and individuals that maybe can't afford insurance or choose not to purchase it because it's too expensive. Okay, I'm going to, in the interest of time, I'm going to jump to page six and talk about the components of 2987, the -A6 bill. For individual waivers, we're talking about the individual market now. Currently, waivers are not permitted. And a waiver, by the way, if an individual applies for coverage to Regents, in the past, we can't do it anymore, but several years ago, and I think some states today, Regents could come back to me if I was applying for coverage and say, Len, we'll cover you, but we're not going to cover your bad knee. That's a waiver. I could accept coverage subject to a carve-out for my knee. That's what a waiver is. Today in Oregon, we have two choices as a carrier. We can either accept an individual applying for coverage or reject them. If they're rejected, there's guaranteed coverage through the state's high-risk pool. And that's the choice that the individual has, or they can remain uninsured. Under 2987, and this is page 1, lines 5 through 24, and it carries over to page 2, the waiver that we're proposing...
Is that in the A6 amendment?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
Thanks. The waiver in 2987-A6 has to be limited to a specific condition. We worked with DCBS and the agents in particular on this piece because there was concern that waivers had been abused in the past. So under 2987, We can use a waiver, but it has to be subject to a very specific condition, and it has to use an ICD-9 code, which is the International Classification of Diseases. That's a very large manual, of which I know very little about. It's about 1,700 pages. That's what hospitals, and I believe physicians for sure, use when they bill for services. So it's very specific as to what the disease or condition is, and we thought it would be a good benchmark to use for waivers. The waiver cannot be subject to any secondary condition. So if you're waiving hypertension or high blood pressure, that would not apply to a secondary stroke or a heart attack. That was another concern that was raised. So the waiver would be a specific condition, no secondary condition that's either related or not related to the excluded condition. Also, the waiver can only be up for a period of 24 months.
Excuse me. If a person has a stroke, for instance, how do you determine for sure? Okay, what kind of a way? Okay, if a person has high blood pressure, would that be considered in determining a waiver? Would you say, I'm not going to cover you because you have high blood pressure even though you're under medication? Is that?
I believe today there are a number of different factors, and I think that would be one that would be looked at as to whether or not the individual would be accepted for coverage.
Okay.
Does that answer?
Well, partially, because I don't know if there is a stroke if you can pinpoint the cause of it entirely. I mean, and that's why it would be difficult to, you know, if you say related, you're covered for that and related.
That was part of the problem, is that any time you got into a secondary condition, whether it was related or not related, sometimes it is very difficult medically to determine a cause. So what this bill says, mm-hmm. only the condition, nothing else, whether it's related or not related, as determined upon a medical finding, which I really couldn't walk through.
Well, I guess that's the difficult thing about this, is determining what... You end up having had a stroke and determining the cause of it, whether or not it's a blood clot or if it's an aneurysm or another blockage of something that caused that to happen. Is that what you would have to determine, or would
no,
you
cover
the stroke?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the way the bill is drafted, you wouldn't have to determine what the cause of the secondary condition was.
Okay. Well, that's what I was getting at.
You're right. You would not have to determine that, because that could not be excluded under any event.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator
Fisher. I guess I would want a little clarification here, because I'm a bit puzzled. You used the example of high blood pressure. Now, obviously, from what I understand, glaucoma is somewhat influenced by high blood pressure, which is in a high condition, and you had wavered out high blood pressure. And you had a stroke that was related, say, generally speaking, to high blood pressure, then is that, or what would the condition be? Would it just be that blood pressure medication and stuff like that wouldn't be paid for during the time, but a stroke that would happen, regardless of whether it was caused by high blood pressure, would be covered?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Vice Chair, Senator Fisher, that's correct.
So it does just refer to that specific situation and not something. In other words, if I had a knee that was bad and you wavered that out and I fell and got a concussion because of that knee, that wouldn't be related.
That is correct.
Okay.
You're welcome. In addition, the waivers can only be up for a period of 24 months. And what that means for individuals is once, if you do accept coverage subject to a waiver, and it's up to 24 months, once the 24 months is up, that doesn't mean the insurance carrier will drop coverage. The insurance carrier can't, because it's guaranteed renewable. So this will actually give individuals an avenue into the private insurance market, and they will remain there unless they decide to leave. if that makes sense. So, the, for example, a bad knee, if that's subject to a waiver up to 24 months, I won't have coverage for my knee for 24 months, but after that period of time, I do have coverage for my knee.
Senator Mitch.
Help me understand the population that you're trying to, you're making these changes for, I'm assuming, are persons who are currently uninsured. Is that right?
Correct.
You're trying to craft a methodology by which insurance can be provided for more people who assumedly are now uninsured. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, that's correct.
To some less than quality product.
This would not apply to current insurers. It applies to individuals that we're trying to get into the market.
All right. One other issue you can put in. In 1993, when we created the Oregon Health Plan, 91, we had this figure of 400,000 uninsured people in Oregon. Population has increased by about 800,000 to a million people. I see we still have the same 400,000 people uninsured. So it always makes me wonder where that number comes from, because it seems to stay constant no matter what we do.
Still a problem.
800 on Oregon Health Plan.
Another important point of the waiver piece is that I mentioned it gives the individual another option, because right now they're either accepted or rejected. Under 2987, you can be accepted, rejected, or accepted subject to a waiver. If I accept coverage subject to a waiver, if I'm offered coverage subject to a waiver, I can still treat that as a declination of coverage and go to OMIP, just as if I had been actually rejected. So it gives me another choice to make. Rather than just getting rejected and my only choice is OMIP, I can be accepted subject to a waiver. Now I have the choice. I can accept that coverage or treat it as a rejection and still go to OMIP. There is a January 2008 sunset provision on the waiver. In fact, there's a 2008 sunset on each of the components that I'll discuss today of the three. If there are no other questions on the waivers, I'll go to rate bands that I think are maybe the most confusing to explain. The second component, and now we're talking about small group insurance. No longer individual, this is small group. Currently, we're at a 2-to-1, what we call a 2-to-1 rate band in Oregon. And if you go to page 8, slide 15, I tried to come up with a graph here or a diagram that made sense to me and hopefully will make sense to you. In Oregon, an insurer currently files its geographic rates with the insurance division. So we can have the same product, but in different geographical areas, we can have different rates. I looked at some rates, and they don't vary all that much, I don't believe. But I know Joel is testifying later with the insurance division and may give you more information on that. I don't think there's a lot of variation between these geographic areas, but we can differ our rates among these areas. So we file those with the division. Then once we have our geographic rates, then we can go plus or minus 33% from that filed rate based on the employer's composite age. Okay. Now, if you look at this diagram, what 2-to-1 means is the highest rate can be no higher than 2 times the lowest rate. So if you take a geographic average rate of 100, you could go down 33% to 67 or up 33% to 133, and that's because 2 times 67, although it's 134, it's roughly 133. What we would like to do in 2987, what this does, is it moves, it expands that compressed band to a 2.5-to-1 band, which means we can go up 43% or down 43%. What we believe that will do, it will allow us to attract employers with a younger composite age mix. If you're an employer with 3 employees, 2 are 30 years old and 1 is 58, the 58-year-old employee is not going to pay any more than the 30-year-old employees. It's the employer's composite age. That's the premium that they will pay.
Finish your sentence.
Okay.
Now, this all sounds really good, and you attract new employees who are younger, and it's a composite, so the rationale is that the rate will automatically go down to adjust to the younger people who are newly employed, right?
Who are newly employed?
Well, I mean, as you have more people in the plan, your composite, the mean will adjust itself. Now, will the insurance division keep track of that? In terms of checking your rates, is this something that somebody else is going to verify?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the insurance division does keep track of our rates, I believe, and I'm not completely familiar with the section of the statute I'll quote you, but there are requirements that I believe we can only change rates once in a 12-year period or at renewal.
12 months, maybe.
Or did I say 12 years? Mm-hmm. 12 months.
Okay.
And so that upon renewal, we'd be able to make an adjustment.
Each time you make an adjustment, it will be based on the rate, the average age, and then that will be submitted to the insurance administrator.
That is correct.
Yeah, okay, good.
The rate wouldn't fluctuate each time an employee was added or left.
I understand that. But you do have the flexibility to move the rate, and so
yes.
Based on the average age of the people that work for you, and that will be reported each time you apply for a rate change.
I believe that's how it would work.
Well, Joel will be...
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
The insurance division was concerned about, I should mention this bill passed, 2987 passed unanimously through the House. I think there were six absentees, but unanimously through committee and then on the House floor with a 4-to-1 rate band. But after that, we continued to work with DCBS, and there was concern that a 4-to-1 rate band simply pushed it too far on the upper end as well, that some employers with an older employee mix would be hurt by that. And so in working with DCBS, we finally arrived at a 2.5-to-1. And we felt like that's about as low as we could go and still have some meaningful change. If it's too low, you can't go either way. We're not able to make the rate attractive for these younger populations. Okay.
Senator Minnis.
You guys don't use credit scoring, do you?
No, we didn't. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, we do not. On slide 17, this is still on rate bands, but it's just to show that at a 2-to-1, if you look at it, we have the age range, and then we have a subsidy at 2-to-1. So if you look at the middle column, that's showing that for the youngest population, they're paying rates that are really 29% higher. So they're subsidizing the other populations, older populations, by 29%. If you look at the oldest population, 65 plus, they're being subsidized by 46.8% because they're paying 46.8% less than what would be in the middle. If you go to a 2.5-to-1, you can see there's still a very healthy subsidy for your older populations. And what it allows us to do on the younger is, as you can see, they would be subsidizing less, so we would be able to offer lower rates. If there are no questions, the easiest part of all of this is the participation credit, another part of 2987. This is simply a 5% credit that an insurer can make to a small employer group in which all of the employees enroll. A carrier that does this will have to offer that to all small employers in which all employees enroll. So you can't pick and choose, well, this small employer with all employees enrolling we'll give the credit to, but this employer over here with all employees enrolling we won't. You can't do that. If you use this credit program, you have to use it for all small employer groups that have all employees enrolling. And that, too, is subject to the 2008 sunset.
Okay. Questions?
Mr. Chairman, if I might make a couple comments, John Palf, again, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I'd just like to summarize by directing your attention to page 5 of the handout, one that Len skipped in his presentation for brevity's purposes. But the uninsured population that was referred to by Senator Minnis, This is data from the Office of Health Policy in the state of Oregon, and it is the last available data, and I think it was 1998 or thereabouts. But you can see by looking at the data who the uninsured in Oregon happened to be by age group. And you see that the bracket of 18 to 29-year-olds is 22% versus 65 and over at 2%. Clearly, the targeted group of this bill is the 18 to 40-year-old person who is working with a group like themselves. This bill, and the rate band in particular, will allow insurance companies, not just ours, but all insurance companies, to offer policies at a premium that will be lower than if this bill does not pass. That is the group we're trying to get coverage for. It does not affect each individual within that group. As Lynn pointed out, it would be the composite of the total group. But this group and small group policies in the state of Oregon are in a critical condition. We're in a death spiral of the healthier, younger people pulling out, leaving the older people who are more prone to illnesses still in. Any insurance system that has that going on is going to fail. There's federal legislation that, if it passes, will more than amplify this kind of a death spiral. We're hoping that doesn't pass and we're working against it. But this is all that you have before you as a legislature this session to deal with this problem. So we hope that you will act on this bill. As it's pointed out, it sunsets, so we'll be back, hopefully giving a report next session, and it sunsets after the following session. So hopefully it came to you unanimously from the other side, which with much larger rate bands through compromise. We've agreed to narrow those substantially, and we just ask for your yes vote.
Okay. Thank you. Did you wish to testify?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peggy Annette, please. Now, we're going to ask that you try to be brief because we're running out of time. Already running out of time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America, and I will be very brief, and hopefully my comments will complement what testimony you just heard from Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. And first, I would like to say to Senator Minnis, I'm taking a look at the 400,000 number. I've been looking at the uninsured numbers in Oregon for over 10 years, and it doesn't make any difference what the calculation or what the methodology is. The numbers are still pretty close to the same, so I finally decided that it's a lot of people and it didn't make any difference. Anyway, I'm here to support the Dash and Six amendments to House Bill 2987. As you're aware, health insurance premiums are the biggest reasons for the decline in the private insurance coverage, and also it is an equally significant issue in the OHP discussions that are currently underway. What I have done is I've attached a table that is actually a variation on the Regents information, and it shows by segment as to what has happened in the private coverage market in Oregon. What astonishes me is a small number of people that we actually have in the individual market as well as the small group market. We have now only 134,000 individuals covered in the individual market and about 240,000 in the small employer market. That's out of a population of 3.5 million. When I was looking at the information, for the Oregon Health Plan, and I realized that in the Oregon Health Plan projected for the next biennium, we have 330,000 individuals expected to be enrolled in the Medicaid categorically eligible population. That is 90,000 more people than we're expecting to even see in the small group market. That kind of juxtaposition highlights the kind of issues that we're looking at with regard to the affordability in the small group market and in the individual market. House Bill 2987 attempts to provide some new means of encouraging people to both stay in the market, and this is specifically in the small group market, as well as encouraging people to join the individual market. The changes are not that significant, but they do provide some very necessary new underwriting flexibility. I recently reviewed a table that showed the rating restrictions for employer small employer market throughout the country. Oregon is one of the most restrictive in the country presently, and in fact, when I was looking at the states that have some form of rating restrictions, over half of them include other factors that can be included in the calculations, such as the type of industry that the small employer is in, as well as tobacco use. None of those factors are presently used in Oregon, and we were looking to rate banding adjustments to provide some greater flexibility. We are also very willing to work with the insurance division to monitor this and review the dynamics of the small employer and the individual market over the next biennium, as well as the ensuing biennium, because I think we all understand that the dynamics are changing and we have some serious problems. The last bit of information that I attached was, again, just to give you a perspective on the cost of health insurance in Oregon. I did talk to some folks from the insurance division and actually came up with an approximation of how much money is spent in terms of insurance coverage subject to the insurance code. It ends up being approximately $4.4 billion. That means that a 1% increase in premiums in Oregon can generate a $44 million increase in premium cost. At the current trend rates, which people talk about, 15%, that suggests that the health insurance cost in Oregon with the 15% trend would be $666 million. That is a significant amount of money. And for those reasons, I think that we really do need to look for new tools in terms of being able to stabilize the cost in the particularly in the individual and in the small group market. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no questions. Joel, would you come up, please?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Joel Ario, Insurance Administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I know you have a long agenda today, so I'll be very brief and then be happy to take questions. I think what the bill does in terms of waivers and in terms of rate bans is well described by region, so I'll skip that part of my presentation and just focus on two issues. One, the trade-offs in each of those areas that the committee faces in deciding what to do, and then two, our amendments that have to do with the ability to study these issues and the sunset provision.
Okay.
On the trade-offs, the waiver issue in the small group market, we now have a six-month pre-ex exclusion. This would extend that to 24 months. So the negative side of that is that some people will get longer periods of non-coverage under this bill than they get currently. The positive is that we would hope it would lead to covering more people. As Senator Minnis testified, when carriers can accept or reject, oftentimes in today's marketplace, they reject people with these conditions that they don't want to cover. So we hope it expands coverage, but it will also lead to some people having longer periods of exclusion than they currently would. So that's kind of the trade-off on the waiver issue. On the rate band issue, it's a little more complex. We do give the proponents credit for reducing the rate bands from their original request of a 4-to-1 spread, which would have led, I think, to some significant rate increases for groups with older workforces, down to a 2.5-to-1. So it doesn't have the same potential to increase rates as much for older workers as it did, but it still will basically reduce rates for younger based groups, by charging older base groups more for insurance. And so that's the trade-off that the committee feels we'll face. We did suggest to the proponents a different way of doing this, which would have said, keep the top cap where it is, so you can only go 33% above the geographic average rate, but you can go down even more than this proposal allows. You could go down 50%. That would be the same 2.5-to-1 ratio that they proposed, but it would, all of the change would be on the lower end, and if it worked, as the proponents suggest, to attract a lot of new, younger workers into the marketplace, you could then achieve that overall decreases in per person or average costs, and so you wouldn't have to necessarily change the rate on the top side. And some states have experimented with that, but the proponents didn't think, essentially they didn't think that they could get, offer the rate decreases that they'd like to offer to attract young workers in without having corresponding rate increases for older workers. So that's the trade-off in that area. Again, we're not here to support or oppose, but simply try to explain to the committee the trade-offs on those two issues. In terms of the amendments that if the bill is to move forward that we would definitely like to see are the ability to collect data. You've heard a lot of data presented today. Much of that is not certain data because right now there are enough questions about the way in which reporting comes in on the size of the small group and the size of the individual market that these 10 and 15% reductions. I think it's clear there's a trend towards reductions, but whether those numbers are precise, we can't vouch for that. Peggy and I spent a long time talking about this, and the data is just not as tight as it could be, and so we want to be able to collect data under these bills to determine whether they actually have the impacts that we hope they do in terms of making these marketplaces more healthy, increasing the number of covered lives. And then we would like to see a four-year sunset, so in essence, once we collect the data, we can come back and report to the legislature on whether these trade-offs that I'm talking about are working to actually improve the marketplace or not. So that's our testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Now, what's the amendment for data collection?
Mr. Chairman, it is in the A6 amendments. The section 3 of the A6 is the, which is on page 2, is the amendment that would allow for the collection of the data, and on page 30, section 9, is the amendment that would implement the four-year sunset.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Good. Questions? Okay. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Steve Doughty and Lisa Tressel, would you, both of you, please come up? I don't know, are they together?
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Doughty. I'm health insurance agent. I'm the vice president of Northwest Employee Benefits. I'm also a past president of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters, which is an organization that represents the insurance agents throughout the state of Oregon, and I'm here offering testimony on their behalf. And essentially, our testimony is in support of this measure. I forgot to. I'll give you my testimony.
Okay. Can you just summarize that for us, please?
I will. I'll be very brief because much of what has already been said I'm in support of. But we as agents are the ones on the front lines delivering the rate increases that have been spoken about here. We know personally how employers and individuals suffer from this. But we support the expanding of the rate bands for the reasons that have been suggested here, although we think that they should be higher than what's proposed at 2.5%. When small group reform was originally passed in the 1995 session, the rate bands were 3-to-1, and then they were compressed in October of 1999. And it's interesting, one of the charts that was shown by Regents shows that in the year 2000 is when we saw a significant decrease in the number of insureds in the state of Oregon. I'm not saying that the rate bands were the sole culprit for that, but they certainly were a contributing factor. And I think going back to 3-to-1 would certainly take us back where we originally started and would be a positive thing. So I would encourage the support of the rate banding. It would allow us to attract a younger, healthier population. The only way we're going to lower the cost of health care is to change the geographic average rate, to lower that. Mm-hmm. And you do that by attracting the younger population. We support the other provisions of the credits for the small employers when they for people who have double coverage. We support that. And also the the specific the exclusions for medical conditions. We support that as well. We see too many individuals who are rejected for very minor conditions and end up in OMIP. The purpose of OMIP is not to cover those people. It's for people who are truly uninsurable. And the way the current law is written, the carriers are rejecting these people outright, and their only choice is OMIP. This would give them more choices, and we support that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. That was about 225 words a minute, sir. I'm a court reporter, and that was pretty quick, but thank you.
She has every word.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and we're here in support of House Bill 2987 and the Dash 6 amendments, particularly as it relates to the rate banding and the discount for 100% participation, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you, Lisa. Okay, thanks. Lynn Marie Kreider, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Marie Kreider, Research Director at the Oregon AFL-CIO. We raised concerns about this bill on the House side. Unfortunately, I wasn't aware that amendments were being drawn and this bill was being heard until a few minutes ago. The reason we raised the concerns on the House side were essentially that in insurance, the purpose of insurance is to spread the risk, and that includes the risk that the risks between folks that are older and folks that are younger, and the employers who employ people that are older and people who are younger. You simply can't lower costs for employers of young workers without raising the cost to employers that happen to have an older workforce. And our concern is that in an effort to expand coverage among employers of older workers, that we will end up pushing, making health insurance unaffordable for another group of employers. We do believe that the Dash 6s are a considerable improvement over what came through the House. The 4-to-1 rate band was really quite frightening when you looked at the numbers. And 2.5 is better. We think the sunset is an improvement. We think the study is important. We would have preferred an opportunity to examine further whether this was a trade-off that made sense. We have no problems with any other provisions of the bill, but we would have recommended to you that you eliminate Section 4, which is the rate band change, and perhaps consider something such as the insurance division essentially I described to you a few minutes ago. That is something that allowed really low rates for low-wage employers employing young workers, but maintained the cap on the rates at the high end so that we don't end up pushing those employers out of coverage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kreider, have you seen the information that Blue Cross Blue Shield gave to us in this little handout?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I don't know whether I've seen that. I have seen some of the material. I saw what they shared on the House side, and they also met with me and showed me some of their material.
Okay. On slide number 17, they showed the impact of the wider rate bands, and even at 2-to-1, it appears to me that the younger people are supplementing the older people. And 2.5-to-1, that evens out a little bit more. And so, to me, I think that's appropriate because, and the committee administrator is handing you a copy of that. If you look on, it's on page 9, and it's the top of page 9 on slide 17. And so your argument that it's spreading the risks, and if you have older workers, they're going to pay more. Well, I kind of think the younger workers have been paying more for the older workers, and it needs to even out a little bit more, don't you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, or excuse me, Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker.
Hear what she calls me.
Yes, there is certainly right now some cross subsidization of employers with low wage, or excuse me, I keep saying this wrong, with younger workforces toward those with older workforces. And I think that's appropriate. I'm not troubled by the level of subsidization. I understand that that's a policy question, but it seems to us at the Oregon AFL-CIO that that cross-subsidization that we have right now is appropriate. It allows an employer to retain a workforce over time, and to, while they're young, that employer may be paying more than he would have to if he was simply paying the cost of covering those workers. But when the workforce ages and becomes older, that employer will get the benefit of the cross-subsidization.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, seeing no others wishing to testify.
Thank you.
Thanks. I will close the public hearing and open a work session on...
Sure.
Yes.
Move the dash 6 minutes to 3 6 minutes.
Senator Minnis moves the dash 6 amendments, 86, to House Bill 2987. Comments? Would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Fisher?
Aye.
Chair
Borkow? Aye. Okay, next motion.
Chairman, I move House Bill 2987 as amended to the floor of the Senate. Did it come here? I waste
okay. So, Senator Minnis moves House Bill 2987 as amended to Ways and Means.
With a due pass.
With a due pass recommendation. With a due pass. Okay.
Yeah.
Comments?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the presentation we've had this afternoon. I much prefer this bill as a way to bring costs down for employers and bring more people in the market than some bill that's coming over from the House that erases some mandates that we've worked very hard at getting insurance coverage for over the years. I'm saddened that so few individuals are covered under policies in the state, 134,300. My son is one of those, and I choose to pay that policy for him because he thinks he's invincible, and he wants to spend his money on other things. And unfortunately, a lot of young people in that age group, he's 25, believe the same way. And I think whatever we can do to entice them into the pool to get involved and get covered, we can keep them off the Oregon Health Plan, we can get them prescription drug coverage, and we can actually do something positive here. I don't know how much longer I'm going to continue to pay that for my son when he finally gets his senses together and realizes he needs it, but it's relatively inexpensive policy. It's I just went up because he turned 25, but I think this is a way to approach it, and I'm mindful of what Ms. Kreider said, but I'm also mindful of what we were shown in the graph, and I think this is necessary.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, question.
What's the reason it's supposed to go away from Maine's beyond? Mr.
Chair, Senator Minnis, it has a subsequent referral from the President's office, and I'm not aware
of the only reason.
It. We do have a fiscal impact that's attached to your packet.
Did the previous measure that existed before this amendment have a fiscal impact? That this current motion or amendment, do we know whether it does or does not?
We don't.
We do not.
No, we have not done that yet.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator Fisher.
I was wondering about that, and then it slipped my mind until we actually took our vote. I don't have a fiscal statement.
Well, if you'd like to rescind.
Senator, it's probably stapled to your staff measure summary.
Well, it is. It's stapled.
With your permission, I'd like to withdraw my motion and restate another motion.
That's fine.
overwhelming way. And I'd like to move that the bill be sent to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation as amended, with a request to the Senate President that the referral to the committee be rescinded. And Mr. Chair, if I can speak to the motion. The effect of that motion would be to allow it to go to the floor if there is no fiscal need for it being Ways and Means. But if the President disagrees, then by virtue of his disagreement, it ends up in Ways and Means. So it may expedite it if we get a chance to identify that fiscal issue.
Okay. Senator Minnis withdraws his motion and has a new motion to rescind the Ways and Means referral and to send the bill to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation on the condition of approval by the President of the Senate and the President pro tem. So that's the new motion. Yes.
I think the decision.
Oh, we just.
Voted. Well, I guess you're right. Never mind.
Okay.
As amendment, okay. I'm just curious as to whether pro tem has to agree on this particular motion. If that's what you're working with,
we've been doing that all along. Right.
So stated.
Okay.
All right, with a long motion.
Would you please call the roll?
Aye.
Senator
Spahr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Fisher?
Aye.
Aye. Having the constitutional majority, it passes unanimously, and I'm saving 875 for you. Who would like to carry this bill? Senator Fisher would. Thank you. Now, I'm sorry that we don't have time to hear your second bill. You took so much time on the first one that we just had. Okay, we will hear it briefly. So the next bill is House Bill 3431A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Oh, boy, I don't know. I've opened a public hearing.
On what bill?
As the bill came to our committee, it permits the insurance carriers offering individual health benefit plans to limit individual health benefit plans in which the individual may elect to enroll. It makes the individuals who were denied coverage under the initial plans eligible to apply for coverage under OMIP. We do have two amendments that are in your packet, the dash A3s and the dash A4s, which are stapled backwards. Sorry about that. However, you have those two amendments. And this bill does not have a subsequent referral.
Okay. Doug, would you like to lead off?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, Doug Barber, representing the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. House Bill 3431 should be a piece of cake after the last bill. This one is much simpler. It only applies to the individual insurance market. With me is Steve Doty, who will explain some of the provisions, and I'll talk a little bit about the amendments.
Okay. Steve?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Doty. I will say much more than essence. I just was here, but just to summarize what this bill does, it is very simple. It only affects the individual policies that are being sold. Under current law, insurers, when they issue a policy, if they accept an applicant, they have to be willing to issue any of their policies that they sell. So the applicant can choose from a very low deductible to a very high deductible. And so when they underwrite that applicant, they're very restrictive, and that's why they're rejecting a significant number of these applicants, and they're ending up in OMIP. And so their only choice then is OMIP. This would give the insureds another choice. It would give them the opportunity to be offered a policy different from the one they applied for. For example, if an individual applied for a $500 deductible plan and the insurance carrier felt that the health risk of the individual was such that they didn't want to issue the $500 deductible, but they would be willing to issue a $1,000 deductible or a $2,000 deductible, they could do that under this bill. That would allow the insurer the opportunity to either accept that policy with that higher deductible with no waivers or exclusions, or they could go to OMIP. Or if the other bill that we just spoke about passes, they could be offered a third alternative, which would be a policy with waivers. So we think this just expands the flexibility of the carriers to offer health insurance to individuals, and hopefully more people will be covered and fewer people will go into OMIP.
Okay, thank you.
And Chair Morissette, if I might, I've spoken with many of you about this bill. The goal really is to keep so many people from going into the high-risk pool. And as Steve said, what we're seeing now is this defensive underwriting. Individuals, when they apply for insurance, can pick from any policy the carrier has, so they have to assume when they're doing the underwriting that they're going to pick the least restrictive, that $100 deductible plan, even if what they're applying for, as in a recent case for one of the agents, was a $5,000 deductible plan. The family got turned down because they had asthma. Well, they were a good risk for a $5,000 deductible plan. They wouldn't have been a good risk at $100 deductible. So the carriers, under the current rules, are denying, they're sending these people to the high-risk pool. What this bill will allow them to do is to underwrite for the plan that people are applying for. People apply for a $5,000 deductible plan, they get accepted, that's what they can accept, and they can get the kind of coverage that they need. So we think it's a good plan, that a good bill that will offer people, allow more people to get private individual insurance coverage. The two amendments that have been introduced come from the insurance division. The A3 amendments are the reporting requirement. It's the exact same language as you saw in 2987. What it says is that the insurance division can ask the carriers for information so they can assess the impact of this measure. The -A4 amendment is the sunset. Again, this is the same sunset that you saw in 2987. So,
Mr. Chair, that's sure. A long amendment for a sunset.
Apparently, they rewrote the entire bill in order to add the three lines at the end. They must have had extra paper down in LC or something. With that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, the back of each page is a different bill. That's why they did it. Other questions?
Yes.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Doty or Mr. Barber, you could answer this for me. When someone applies for a policy, an individual policy, as my son did, we looked at what we wanted, and so we made application, and we got what we wanted. What if you're turned down? So I think we applied for a $200 deductible. What if we were turned down for that low deductible amount? Is the insurance company obligated to tell me why we have been turned down and why they're offering a higher plan? And does this bill impact that in any way?
Well, Brett, Chair Morissette, Senator Walker, the insured is entitled to know why they've been turned down. And under current privacy rules, the agents were out of that loop. We used to be involved in that aspect, but not anymore. But the insured could petition the insurance carrier for the reasons as to why and they will communicate directly with them as to why.
My concern is that someone applies for a low deductible and you want to push them into a higher deductible because you don't want to cover this person, yet they may not have really too many illnesses that would exclude them from a low deductible. So then they appeal to the insurance company, they give them a list of the reasons why, and then that person, where do they go from there? The insurance division?
Senator Morissette, Senator Walker, I believe that that's their only option at that time would be to appeal to the insurance department. But I'm not. I don't think that. I think it is up to the insurance company to make that decision. There aren't any real strict guidelines, I think, as to why they reject. They just have the ability to reject.
Okay.
And Senator Walker, my understanding is currently they would just reject. Whereas under this bill, what they could do is they could say, well, not 200, but would you be interested in 500 deductible? And if you say no, if you're not interested, you still have the option of going to the high-risk pool, which was your old choice anyway.
Right. Okay, so there's still consumer protection here.
Consumer protection is all there, yeah.
Yet if you go to AllMIP, Mr. Chair, I don't know if you know this, they cover Viagra. I thought that was very interesting to find that out. Blue Shield doesn't cover it, but OMIP does.
I was going to say, but not... Thank you for that information. Thanks. Joel, would you...
I think it's inappropriate that they do that.
Is that a warning to OMIP to look out for a rush?
That is.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record again, Joel Ariel from the Insurance Division. I can tell you that Rocky just answered that question, Senator Walker. He thinks Viagra is very important to cover under OMIP, so that's why it's covered. That's actually not true.
Oh.
No one's listening to me here, obviously.
I love these Viagra jokes. You know, they get pretty gross after a time. But anyway.
You may continue.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be very brief on this bill. I think it is a simpler bill than the last one. And again, I just want to illustrate the trade-off for the committee here. Unfortunately, there are no simple answers in healthcare. So both the bills you have before you today do involve some trade-offs, and our job is to illustrate those trade-offs for you and then to talk briefly about the collection of data and the sunset. The trade-off here is that under the current law, as the previous witnesses testified, if somebody's accepted into this individual market, they get a choice of all the plans. Under here, they can have those choices restricted. And in answer to Senator Walker's questions, they do have a right to the reason for the rejection, but typically the reason will simply be health status, and that is satisfactory under current law. So there really isn't any protection under current law for the consumer to be able to argue, well, my health status wasn't bad enough to be given a $1,000 deductible. I should have been given a $500. As long as there's a basis in health status for the rejection, that's what the law requires, is that kind of notice. So presumably there will be some people who will get more restricted options under current law. Now, I think it's a reasonable assumption on the carrier's part that most of those people would have been told no, categorically no, and wouldn't have gotten any option under current law. But it's a speculative as to whether some of them, if the choice was yes or no, might have been written by the carriers for all the plans rather than for a restricted plan. And it's also speculative as to whether some of those people who are given one option will now choose the OMIP route rather than this, and it could lead to an increase in OMIP. All of those things are speculative and depend on the marketplace dynamics. So those are the trade-offs here, and that's why, again, under this bill, we strongly support the A3 amendments and the A4 amendments, which give us the right to collect data to determine how this is working. Is it actually growing the individual market, which we hope it will, or is it leading to more people in OMIP, for instance? And then the sunset, again, kind of forces this to be reconsidered after we've looked at the data and determine whether it's working effectively in the marketplace. Be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Senator Minnis.
So do you have capacity in your agency to crunch the numbers and input the data? Or do you have is there a budget request to do this, or is this something you're layering on your existing responsibility?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, we believe the kind of data that we need here is relatively straightforward, and that we don't have a large fiscal on this, and we don't think it will take a lot of work. There already are some underlying data reporting requirements, and so this is really in the nature of a clarification to make it clear that we can get the data we need. But I don't think it's a major project.
No new computers, no
FTE,
decision packages with five employees. And
oh, I know.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, no.
Yeah, okay. Further questions? Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Seeing no others wishing to testify, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3431. Do we have...
No, open a work session.
Gosh. I'll open a work session. Okay. Yes. The work session is open. Mr. Chair.
I would move the one at a time, though, right?
Yeah.
I would move the -3 amendments to House Bill 3431.
Okay. Senator Fisher moves the -3 amendments to House Bill 3431. Discussion. Okay. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Minnis?
Aye.
Senator Spire?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Fisher?
Aye.
Chair
Boyce? Aye.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would move the -4 amendments to House Bill 3431.
Okay. Senator Fisher moves the -4 amendments to House Bill 3431. Objection? Seeing none. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Minnis?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Fisher?
Aye.
Chair Boyce?
Aye. Okay, the bill passes unanimously. Do we have
The amendments
have passed. Oh, God. Okay, the amendments have passed. One more time.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Fisher.
I would move that we send House Bill 3431 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Very good. Senator Fisher moves House Bill 3431 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Just, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just wanted to say that I appreciate the comments of Joel Ario, because I am concerned that consumers might be bumped into higher deductible plans, and so I'm real curious to look at the data when this comes back to us to just make sure that this bill is being used as it's intended.
Would you make note of that, Joel, and send a copy of it to Senator Walker immediately? Thank you.
I get a lot of
paper. That's
a budget.
I'm half succeeded. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Lindin.
Aye.
Senator Stein.
Aye.
Senator Walker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Fischer.
Aye.
Chairman
Lorenz. Aye. Passed unanimously, and Senator Walker will carry.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, we will. We've had a recess for on Senate Bill 875, and we will continue the public hearing on Senate Bill 875. Senator Fischer was, I think you were, I don't know if you were here during the testimony of Representative Green and Dr. Goldberg. They had to leave, so we had that part of the testimony early. So Tom Holt and Jim Gardner, would you please come forward? Senator, our Representative Greenlick is back.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt, Executive Director of the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. Representative Greenlick earlier, I think, described very well the long process that we went through to arrive at the product that you have before you today. It is, I think it's fair to say, a very delicate compromise. Probably everyone in the group had something to not like 100% and in it, and some things to like in it, and that's the nature of a good compromise, I think. I think as a group we decided not to make the perfect the enemy of the good, and what we have now is a means to find out, since no state has actually been able to execute a bulk purchasing program as yet. We'll find out now if this actually works. And so with that, we urge you to move this on through the process as it stands.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm an attorney with the Gardner & Gardner Law Firm, and I'm appearing today for PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. I'm not going to condemn this bill to ridicule by lavishly praising it, but rather observe that during my 16-year tenure as the legislative representative in Oregon for PhRMA, I have seen perhaps four or five bulk purchase aggregate negotiating proposals surface, generate initial excitement, and then basically crater, not because we opposed them or tried to kill them, but simply because they fell of their own weight, because they were, for one reason or another, overreaching, overly ambitious, and simply unworkable. This bill, as Tom has put it, has the merit of being a modest, workmanlike effort to see if this concept will work, and I want to commend you, Mr. Chair, in particular, for your tenacity and patience in pursuing this objective.
Thank you. Now, that 16 years didn't include the time that you were a liberal Democratic senator trying to pass these kinds of things, did it?
It excluded that period.
Good. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Senator. The witnesses didn't testify, but I believe that they are also referring to the Dash 8 amendments.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Further questions? Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Lynn Marie Kreider and Mary Beth Healy, please. Both of you come up.
Oh, sorry. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Marie Kreider, Research Director for the Oregon AFL-CIO.
Mary Beth Healy, Executive Director of Oregonians for Health Security.
I guess I'll start briefly, Mr. Chair. Oregon needs a bill to enable Oregonians to pool their purchasing power to drive down the price of prescription drugs. That's because large, powerful purchasers get better prices from manufacturers than individuals or small groups. We appreciate the opportunity that the Oregon AFL-CIO had to participate in work on this bill. However, we believe that the Dash 8 amendments do not give Oregonians the program that they need. That's because, although there are almost 3.5 million Oregonians, this bill leaves most of them out. Indeed, speaking to the question that Senator Walker raised earlier about the numbers of uninsured that the bill would cover, the Oregon prescription drug program that you adopted last year for seniors potentially would cover over 100,000 Oregonians and provide them prescription drugs at the Medicaid rate. This bill adds only about 20 to 25,000 Oregonians to that group by moving down to age 55. We found that folks haven't enrolled in the other program, which had a guaranteed price reduction for them. This one is a bet that the pool is strong enough to provide savings for this additional group. But when you leave most people out of the pool, you create a purchasing pool that doesn't have the muscle to make a difference in the marketplace. And even if it does drive down prices, it will benefit very few. It is possible that this bill will end up being the beginning of something. It might, if a few big public employers that the bill would allow to participate in the purchasing pool actually join it, even though in the short term they probably won't get a big benefit from it. It also will if either in the other house of this body or during another session of the legislature, we truly include large groups of Oregonians that the amendments would leave out and begin to assemble the bargaining power that will truly get us a fair shake from this industry. Until then, Oregonians will continue to pay more than they should have to pay to buy prescription drugs, this bill, with the Dash 8 amendments notwithstanding. We cannot endorse the Dash 8 amendments. We urge you to adopt instead the Dash 1s or something that provides comprehensive inclusion in a purchasing pool for Oregon. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Seeing no questions, Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Mary Beth Healy, and I'm the Director of Oregonians for Health Security. Oregonians for Health Security is a coalitional organization that has been working to unite healthcare professionals, caregivers, consumer organizations, and concerned citizens to advocate for improved access to quality, affordable, and secure healthcare. And over the past year, we've been knocking on the doors of Oregonians to learn firsthand about the issues that they face and accessing that care. And the skyrocketing cost of prescription drugs are a major concern for Oregonians and is one of the biggest cost drivers in overall health care costs. And just as I find a very interesting statistic, for the first time in almost two decades, health care actually tops the list of concerns for small businesses, even over taxes. And so from those small business owners to health care workers without health insurance, Oregonians are tremendously concerned about their and their neighbors' healthcare costs. costs. And we've been bringing you these stories every day through our daily dose. The amendments to Senate Bill 875 before you today begin to address the unsustainable costs of prescription drugs. We're glad to see movement on this vital legislation. Seniors without prescription drug coverage who qualify will be grateful for the help that they get in reducing the cost of their life-saving drugs. I would call your attention, to today's Daily Dose, which profiles Albert Barnes. He's a diabetic from the St. John's area who would benefit from this legislation. Last year, he went with other seniors to Mexico to find savings on prescriptions he needs to manage his diabetes. This legislation means he could buy his prescriptions locally at a lower price than he pays today. Seniors like Albert should not have to choose between buying food and their prescriptions. However, we would encourage you to go further. There are 780,000 Oregonians without prescription drug coverage who pay the highest price for their medications or go without their prescriptions that the doctor recommends. Senate Bill 875 is a step in the right direction, and we could be taking giant steps to improve the lives of Oregonians. A prescription drug purchasing pool that includes state agencies, local governments, as the Dash 8 amendments do, but you add businesses and the 780,000 Oregonians without prescription drug coverage would create the most savings for the state. And I think that's another component that we want to just be thoughtful of as we look to find money to fund vital services. And that estimated cost is $60 million a year. And that would improve access to the prescriptions for most Oregonians and help us to reduce health insurance premiums as well. In the state of Washington, a prescription drug purchasing pool bill just passed. And their bipartisan compromise includes disabled individuals and people over 50 who are at 300% of the poverty level, at the federal poverty level, excuse me. So under the guidelines in Oregon's proposed bill, an individual senior would have to have an income of less than $16,600 per year, where under Oregon's bill, their income could be as high as $26,900. Thank you, Lynn-Marie. Switch those numbers. this incremental increase in the income restriction would help more seniors in need and increase the size of our pool to ensure that we move market share and that the pool is effective. Seniors at 300% of the federal poverty level still need help affording their prescriptions. And the average senior fills 18 prescriptions per year, and some cost over $1,000, making them out of reach for many people. So with my testimony, there is a chart comparing the eligibility criteria of the proposed Oregon bill, Washington's bill, and model legislation that Lynn-Marie spoke of. Ideally, you will enact the strongest bill possible that includes private businesses, Taft-Hartley Trust, the 780,000 Oregonians without prescription drug coverage, state and local governments, and other health care purchasers. And as you know, the purchasing pool is based on volume. The more people we have in the pool, the better our negotiating power. We would like to see the purchasing pool be as successful as possible so that we can see those estimated savings. Again, you know, this could be looked at as a revenue solution for our budget crisis, and the closer we get to the $60 million and covering more people gets us there, I think, is better. But I do appreciate the work that the work group has gone through, and are happy to see something moving. Thank you.
Thank you. Question. Okay. Representative Greenlick, you covered some things earlier that just kind of sum up, if you would. Would you mind coming up and just kind of summing it, and then we will move on because there are no others wishing to testify? Thank you very much for that.
Thank you, sir.
You heard some of the testimony in terms of the pros and the cons and so on. And
well, first, I agree with everything Mary Beth said. I mean, an ideal solution would be wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I hope maybe someday we'll move there. But my experience looking at last year's 71st Legislative Assembly was that there were six bills introduced. One of the six bills had a 15-minute hearing, and the other five had no movement whatsoever. And I think all of us who got involved in this right from the beginning thought that we'd really rather move something that would give us a beginning, that would allow us to test the water, and that the Dash 8's amendments have moved to a place where we have pharma support and the pharmacist support and the governor's support and many of us in the assembly itself. I think what it does is it gives us a chance to get moving, and it is absolutely true. The secret to reducing drug prices is having market share to move. So the success of the endeavor in the first 2 years, or maybe in the first 4 years, really is the extent we can find groups like, for example, a statewide school, as a school teachers group, if that comes on board, other state organizations. The more folks we can get into the pool, the more market share we can move with this, and therefore the more bargaining power we have. So that's ultimately going to be the test. But this, I think, gets us started down the right road, and I do urge the Dash 7 amendments.
Dash 8
amendments. I was just looking through my file. You can see Lynn Marie's file was this thick. Mine was a little less. Okay. Yes, easy to get confused. The Dash 8 amendments are what I'm encouraging.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Yes.
Just so to make the obvious even more clear, you're saying that if we would follow a suggestion to do the Dash 1s or something else instead, we're killing the bill.
That's exactly.
And so it's kind of 8 or nothing.
Well, I think it's not only 8, because I think we've done better than create. Mr. Chair, Senator Shields. I think we've done better than that, because I think what we have now is an opportunity to really move it, because I think we have the enthusiastic support of some of the people who would otherwise be enthusiastically opposed. And while it's lukewarm support on some quarters, that's the worst we are at the moment. And we move from lukewarm to enthusiastic support. And I think that gives us a chance of getting it out of here, getting it out of Ways and Means, and getting it through the House floor, which it would not, which it absolutely would not otherwise have.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just want to, Senator, it's not Dash 1 or Dash 8 or nothing. The problem is that the mechanism and structure doesn't exist to have a bulk purchasing program.
Right.
And so notwithstanding some organizations' desire that everybody in the world be part of this thing, it doesn't exist.
Right.
So and that's the real difficulty here. That's what I'm a little bit disheartened by Lynn Marie Kreider's testimony and the AFL-CIO's position, because I think that this is, in fact, a very good template for the future. And I think anybody who is intellectually honest, when you look at the bulk purchasing mechanisms, and that's why I alluded to the contract issues, you have extraordinary contract issues that have to be overcome. If you want to force PEB in legislatively, you can do that, but you'll have an adverse financial effect on the existing contracts that are there. So this is a mechanism that literally helps develop the process by which you can get to where the AFL-CIO and other organizations would ultimately like to go, by making a process and a product that actually works and can demonstrate it works. It's a demonstration project, because you're really dealing in uncharted waters here. And I really appreciate Representative Greenlake's commitment and his stewardship in overseeing the work group. He did a remarkable job. I really appreciate what he did. So,
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Yes, we're going to have to move along. There's another committee waiting outside to come in. One more building.
Chomping at us. Representative Greenlake, did you take a look at Lynn Marie Kreider and Mary Beth Healy talked about the Washington State program? Did you folks take a look at that in your deliberations?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, we didn't formally look at it. I am familiar with it, and I've looked at the at the consequences, and I've had folks send me information. It's just by the time this moved, we were moving too far down a path to move this, and this could be a logical extension of it.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Good. Now, I will say also that this has been a very long, arduous program process, and I wasn't quite sure we would ever get to where we are today. I felt that we were not able to come together ultimately, but we did. And I received a letter from the city of Springfield telling me that their cost for drugs for employees, they quoted $440,000 a year, which I find extraordinary. They are not self-insured, but they may go that route. So this would allow other groups who currently have insurance to come under this program. They may go self-insured for their medical part and be in this bulk purchasing program. I think it has great possibilities. So we did the best that we could, and I think we have achieved something that does have great potential. So with that, I will close the public hearing and open a work session.
Sure, I'll move the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill.
Okay, Senator Starr moves
875.
Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 875. Further comments? Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Minnick?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Fisher?
Aye.
Chair Lockett?
Aye. Okay, Dash 8 amendments have been approved.
Just go to Ways and Means?
No.
No.
I'm going to let Senator Minnis make the motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 875 is amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Minnis moves 875 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I just want to say thank you to those of you who served on this committee. I know you've worked
well.
Many hours.
There's a group of people who deserve the credit.
They do, and I know this isn't the ideal picture that we'd like to have and the ideal program, but I think it's a good start, and it's better to start out slow than to start out big and fail. So I think this is a good start, and I'm very proud to be a member of this assembly and work with the kind of colleagues that I do. So thank you.
Thank you. Senator Mann. Did you move?
Yes.
You didn't move.
Yes, he did.
Okay. Further discussion? Okay. Would you please call the roll?
Senator Minnis?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Fisher?
Aye.
Chair Lockett?
Aye. Passes unanimously, and Senator Minnis will carry this bill on the floor of the Senate because he had such great success with Senate Bill 819 last session.
That was 2:30 in the morning.
I want to continue his role. Okay, we will open a public hearing on... we close the work session. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2828.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2828, as we received it, authorizes certain nurse practitioners to provide compensable medical services for 90 days, authorizes temporary disability benefits not to exceed 90 days, and to make findings regarding impairment for workers' compensation claims. In your packet, you do have the Dash 85 amendments, which I believe are from MLAC.
Okay. Right?
Okay.
Brian, would you come up, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Brian DeLeishmet representing the Oregon Nurses Association. I know you're on limited time, and I don't know how much history you really need to get here, but
we have all the time in the world. They're going to talk about baseball. We don't care about that. We're going to take our time. We'll be here till 3:30 maybe, so just take your time.
For those of you who haven't followed the history of the ability for nurse practitioners to function as a provider in workers' comp, it goes back actually prior to my history with the association, but I came on board in 1979. In 1979, nurse practitioners were able to provide full treatment to within their scope of practice to patients within the workers' comp system because of the definition of them being considered a practitioner of the healing arts, as the Attorney General interpreted the statute at that point. There was some confusion whether or not that should or shouldn't include certain providers, and subsequent to that, then the statute was clarified that, in fact, nurse practitioners did provide those services. Then we move into the Mahonia Hall phase of workers' comp, in which there was wholesale changes to the provision of care to workers, including on the provider side, who in fact was an attending physician, who was not an attending physician, parameters were put around those providers that were not attending physicians. And nurse practitioners in that sweeping movement were put with restrictions of 30 days or 12 visits for provision of services. Our original bill that was introduced, House Bill 2800, simply put nurse practitioners back into the status of being able to provide compensable care to the workers that in many cases are their own clients. In many communities, they are in fact the primary care provider for those patients, and it didn't make a lot of sense to us that you could treat somebody and get reimbursed if they had a sprained ankle off the job, and that was your patient all the time. But if you were treating them on a workers' comp claim, there was a whole different set of statutes and rules that applied to you and what you could and couldn't do. With the urging of Representative Canope on the House side, who is the chief sponsor of this bill, he put us together with some of the other groups that were interested in the bill, and there was a compromise reached, or we believe there was a full compromise reached on the current status, which is 90 days. Of treatment instead of 30 days of treatment and 90 days of being able to authorize time loss. However, that 90 and 90 did not stand up under the review of MLAC. And if you understand the process of MLAC, MLAC is made up of both labor and management folks. They voted after I think the third time they saw this bill in a couple of different versions that the vote was 6 yes and 9 no. For the bill in its form, but you have to get a majority of both the labor folks and the management folks in order for them to give their blessing. And from that point, actually the House continued to move forward. Despite that blessing, took action on the bill. It passed there 56-1. I do happen to know that the one no vote voted against it simply because, although they supported the bill, just simply because it didn't get the blessing of MLAC, and that was their only objection to it. So the bill is in front of you now as it passed the House. I would mention one additional thing. There is an amendment that we would support. It's a clarifying and amendment. This actually was a drafting error. It's the A7 amendments that are going to be offered by Marshall Cobaugh and the physician's assistants. Inadvertently, when the nurse practitioners were taken out of the 30-day and 12-visit section and put in a separate section at 90 and 90, they also deleted PAs from the 30 and 12. So they were taken out, and we would strongly urge you to adopt the Dash 7s and move the bill the way it is right now. Thank you.
Thank you. LJ. JL. JL Wilson.
Oh.
Sorry about that. I knew it was one of those.
You're in good shape.
I'm in good shape.
And I'm the one that was up all night.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll wait for the handouts to be distributed. With regard, Mr. Chair and members, with regard to House Bill 2828, Mr. DeLashment was right in his accounting of how the measure came about. Again, for the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, State Director of NFIB Oregon, but before you today is the co-chair of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. House Bill 2828 before you was turned down by MLAC. What we are offering to you are the Dash A5 amendments. 2828 as it is allows for 90 days treatment and time loss for nurse practitioners. Like I said, the MLAC committee rejected that proposal. What we are offering in the Dash A5 amendments is along these lines. First, it allows for 90 days treatment and time loss in rural areas to address health care access issues in those areas. And so the 90 and 90 would apply to rural areas as defined in statute. We are also providing that an injured worker with an established relationship with a nurse practitioner, if that worker is part of an MCO, a managed care organization, can bring their nurse practitioner into the MCO. So the governing rules of the MCO would apply to the nurses, so there is some oversight there, and that the nurse practitioner could continue to treat that worker under the auspices of an MCO. And that is, I want to be very clear, the issue for MLAC is the issue of management and oversight. If you're getting to a period where nurse practitioners are treating up to 90 days, that is a period of time in which it is clearly preferable for a doctor to have a look at that injured worker. You have before you a letter from the Medical Advisory Committee that they issued today, and they say it really better than I can in the second paragraph. Complicated work injuries typically last more than 30 days, can lead to permanent impairment, and require the diagnostic acumen that comes only from the extensive training of essentially a doctor. And that's why we're so adamant about the Dash A5 amendments. You also have before you a letter from Governor Kulongoski that was issued on the floor when House Bill 2828 came to the floor, and you can read that for yourself in terms of how he regards MLAC's decision on 2828. So I am here to inform you that MLAC voted unanimously to endorse the Dash A5 amendments this morning, and I forward them to you today. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
How many members of MLAC?
Thank you. Chair Morissette, it's a 10-member committee.
And what was the
half vote? Labor, half management.
What was the individual vote on this issue?
It was labor-supported, House Bill 2828. Management did not.
What was the breakdown?
Myself and Lisa Trussell supported the nurses. The three actual workers' comp practitioners on the management side did not.
And on the labor side?
Everyone voted for it on the labor side.
Okay, so the total vote was 7 in favor and 3 opposed, if you look at the total MLAC board.
You're right. I don't want to split hairs with you, Mr. Chair, but one of the labor representatives is that position is not filled, so it was a 63 vote. You're exactly right.
Well, I understand that, but I do want to get that straight, because I know that there is a block voting in MLAC, and it takes a majority of each side to agree. And even though there's a majority of the board that would vote for something, if it's not a majority of both sides. So,
in terms of process, Mr. Chair, there were two bills that we disapproved of this session. One was voted preferred by management, not preferred by labor, and this one was vice versa. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Wilson, MLAC is an advisory committee, is it not?
Correct. What we are, forwarded by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. You're right.
So they don't make policy. They just give advice.
You're right. Historically, what has happened with MLAC is usually we've had agreement with the committee chairs and governor, and in which they agree to abide by our recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
But it is an informal agreement.
Right. In the legislature, we make policy, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I understand where you're going with this line of questioning. Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to make that clear, because I've seen that this session in my Business and Labor Committee, and I just want to remind MLAC that they're a policy advisory committee, that they don't make the policy, we do. And I appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Could I ask a question of Mr. DeLeishman?
Yes. Brian, would you come up, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brian, having been the victim of Dr. No Jr. yesterday, with a letter that he has sent here on this, can you live with the Dash 5 rather than maybe nothing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, the answer to that question is no. We have continued to work with the division, with the governor's office. We specifically asked them yesterday if, in fact, it came down to this version, the Dash 5s or the Dash 6, give us some direction on what they would or wouldn't do, and they indicated that they couldn't give us that direction. So I have no indication that the governor will, in fact, veto this. And with the bill passing 56-1 on the House, I think that's a pretty strong signal. I would expect that there would be a very strong signal if the Senate passed the bill the same way, that the bill had strong bipartisan support. So I prefer the bill in its current form with the Dash 7 amendments. Thank you for asking, Senator Fisher.
Okay. Thank you. Other comments? Okay. Thank you. Sure. Others wishing to testify? Oh, Martin. Marshall, please come up.
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, good afternoon. My name is Marshall Koba, representing the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. I'm here in support of the Dash 7 amendments, which, as Mr. Glashman mentioned, because of a drafting error not intended by the proponents of the bill, took PAs out of providing this health care service, and the Dash 7s will put them back into the bill. We are also in the Dash 5 amendments, and we'll leave it up to the committee to make the proper policy statement. PAs currently provide health care services to several thousand patients daily. It is important for patient care across the state, especially in rural Oregon, that PAs do not lose any authority, and we urge your support of the Dash 7 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
That's the Senator Fisher. Thanks. Mr. Chair, that's to Senator Fisher.
I'm reading it. Good.
I'm reading. Everything goes through the chair. You got to filter all this stuff.
Is he here on baseball?
Pardon me, please.
No, he's here on the Dash 7 amendments on House Bill 2820.
No one else wishing to testify. I will close the public hearing and open a work session, starting with the Dash 7 amendments. If we want to select that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just want to clarify what Marshall Koba just said, that if you are intending to move the Dash A5s, and I'm not sure what you plan to do, that the A7s are already in there.
The A7s are in the A5s?
In the A5s.
Okay. Well, I would just move the Dash 7, Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker moves the Dash 7 amendments. Discussion. No further, no discussion. Would the clerk call the roll, please?
Senator Minnis?
Nope.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Nope.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Fisher?
No.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. Okay, the motion failed. Any other motion?
Well?
Chair, move the Dash 5 amendment.
No.
Which one had the Dash 7?
The Dash 5. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 5 does have the Dash 7 amendments, and the Dash 5 is the one proposed by MLAC.
Okay, Senator Minnis moves the Dash 5 amendments. Good discussion.
I won't support the Dash 5, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Okay, let's vote.
Well, you asked for discussion, so I'm giving you discussion, and I'm not going to support the Dash 5 because MLAC is an advisory committee only, and I'm just sick and tired of if MLAC approves, we pass the bill. If they don't, we don't. I mean, we make those decisions independently. We were elected to do so, and damn it, I'm not going to support these. This is not appropriate.
Okay. Thank you. Further discussion. Senator Minnis.
I just want to speak to my motion. The reason I'm moving it is because I was here years ago when we gave nurse practitioners additional authority to write scripts, et cetera, and the whole basis for doing that was access in rural parts of the state or underserved parts of the state. I think these amendments are consistent with that policy, and I'm not aware of a compelling need to change that policy at this time.
Okay. Other discussion? Senator Shields.
Well, I'm trying to catch up here a little bit. This bill passed the House 54 or something?
56 to 1, 56 Senator.
56 to 1.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what the dynamic was over in the House that's so different, and why we're compelled to... I mean, they took a look at the MLAC stuff, too, as I understand it. Am I wrong?
No, you're correct, Senator.
So
I'm not sure that the MLAC people were involved. They were involved?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Yes, I guess they were.
So why did this pass the House so overwhelmingly if it's such a big problem here? I'm just trying to figure this out.
Would anyone wish to clarify?
Without disparaging the House.
Without disparaging the House or each other? Both of you come up and give us a hint.
I'll try it first, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Mr. Shields.
Mr. Shields. Senator.
Senator Shields. The Management Labor Advisory Committee on the House side just said we did not approve of House Bill 2828. What the -A5 amendments represent are basically we got to a point of what we would accept with regard to nurse practitioners in bill form. And that is the -A5s in front of you, and that is essentially what's different than what happened on the House side.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I guess I can't analyze the full dynamics of what happened on the House side, but we laid out our case to both the committee, MLAC, and to the House floor, and the vote was 56 to 1. And having discussed the one no vote, why they voted no, it was only because MLAC did not approve of the bill. It was a process question. It was not support or non-support for the bill. So given that, I'm a little stunned that we've come to the discussion that we have on this side. The problem that we have with the A5 amendments is that it in fact sets a very substantial double standard between urban and rural, and we believe that if you are trained exactly the same, whether you're practicing in an urban area or a rural area, you see the exact same type of patient with the exact same injury, to have two different standards of treatment under a workman's comp system is not acceptable. Given that, I will tell you that we floated an amendment that was very close to what the A5s are through the department and to the MLAC members, and it was rejected. And that amendment was 90 days anywhere in the state and an MCO come along, as was a component of the MLAC's proposal, which is if a client or a patient is a member of an MCO, that the nurse practitioner could provide care to that patient under the rules of the MCO and have a come-along. And that was not acceptable to MLAC, and they have come up with the -5 amendments. You know, if it helps break this deadlock, we would be willing to offer those as compromise amendments, those -6 amendments. Senator Walker has those that were drafted on behalf of Senator Brown, who has an interest in this bill. But the one component of the -5s that is unacceptable to us is the difference between urban practice and rural practice. And for any of you who know, access to health care is not just a geographic access to health care. It also is a economic access okay. to health care, and that occurs in the urban areas.
Senator Minnis.
Sure. Brian, you may be absolutely right. However, one of the issues, as I recall, when the deficit and having been in this building long enough, was the discussions in the 80s were to incent persons to actually practice in a rural area. And that's why the expanded authority started. Because we wanted nurse practitioners, because you couldn't get physicians to practice in these areas, and now you're arguing that it's okay to just put them in the urban area. If you put them in the urban area, why would a nurse practitioner want to practice in a rural area? If they can practice in the metro area where you got the bulk of the population, they don't have to go to the eastern Oregon or southern Oregon and open their practice where they have a lot more freedom. I mean, that's the inherent danger in expanding this kind of of authority is that you're going to lose practitioners in rural and southern Oregon. It is an access question as far as I'm concerned.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, nurse practitioners were full participants in the workers' comp system. Prior to the Mahoney Hall, there was no indication that practitioners were moving from one area of the state to another area of the state because of the workers' comp incentive or disincentive.
But, Mr. Chairman, Brian, I'm preceding MLAC and the workers' comp discussion as far as the expansion of authority for nurse practitioners. That was before the whole issue, and it had to do with access, and it had to do with we wanted nurse practitioners to be incented to practice in rural areas.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I was the lobbyist for the Oregon Nurses Association when nurse practitioners got prescription writing and third-party reimbursement in 1979. And you are correct that one of the discussions about that was access to health care. But we also made the case it was not just geographic access, it was economic access. We have nurse practitioners, for example, Mariah Taylor in Northeast Portland that provides care to the very lowest of the low as far as the economic scale, has a clinic, sees these types of patients. So it is both economic and geographic, and we have never said that nurse practitioners are only in this state to function in those areas of the state where no one else is willing to go.
Okay, very good. That it? Thank you. We have a motion on...
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I did not support the Dash 7 amendment simply because I wanted to get a little more discussion here on this particular amendment. I, as an original original sponsor of the original bill, I'm going to go with my instinct in sponsoring that bill, and if the Dash 7 comes back, I will support that, but I'm not going to support the Dash 5 amendment.
Okay.
How do you do that?
We have a motion on 5s, and then we can go through 5 first. We have a motion on 5. So, hold that. Call the roll, please.
Senator Minnis?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
No.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Barker?
No.
Senator Fisher?
No.
Chair Morissette?
No. So, do we have a motion for reconsideration?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would move to reconsider the vote on which we...
The vote on 7.
The vote on the Dash 7 amendments.
Okay. Senator Walker moves reconsideration of Dash 7 amendments. Discussion.
And this is a vote on reconsideration.
Discussion on reconsideration. Okay. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Minnis?
Nope.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
No.
Senator Walker?
Yes.
Vice Chair Fisher?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. Okay. The vote on reconsideration passes 4-2.
Then, Mr. Chair, I would make a motion to pass the Dash 7 amendments.
Okay. Senator Walker moves the Dash 7 amendments. House Bill 2828. Discussion. Call the roll, please.
Senator Minnis?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Fisher?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. Senator,
Mr. Chair,
Amendment 7 passes. Yes.
And Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2828 as amended with the Dash 7 amendment to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker moves House Bill 2828 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
Discussion, yes.
Yeah, I'm just reading the letter from the governor regarding these particular issues, and perhaps this will be a really good test to see if these letters have any meaning or value whatsoever.
Very good. Thank you. Good observation. Other discussion. Okay, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Minnick?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Stein?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Fisher?
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2028 passes unanimously, and I'm going to...
Mr. Chair.
I'm going to think about that in a minute, yes.
I just wanted to say that given Marshall Koba's recent success, I think he wants to move on with the baseball bill now.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Vote explanation.
Senator Minnis.
Minnis?
Senator Fisher, it's the last day, the last meeting.
I think so.
Senator Fisher.
Having been involved in business for a good many years and having dealt with nurse practitioners, I have not, I'm pretty confident in their skills and in their ability and the fact that they have not contributed to a situation that I would say was tough for the workers' comp program, and from that standpoint, that's why I supported the ACO amendment rather than the AFLAC.
Thank you. Do we have a carrier?
Can I make a comment about explanation?
Yes.
I was supporting my
Senator
governor.
Minnis.
I was supporting my governor.
Thank you. Other comments? Do we have a carrier?
I can carry that, or you can carry that, Mr. Chair. You haven't carried one today.
Okay, I'd be very happy to.
Since, well, Senator Starr hasn't carried one
Senator
either.
Senator Starr, would you like to carry this bill?
I'll defer to you.
There was your bill. Would you like to carry it, Senator Fisher?
No, that's all right.
Okay.
I'm just
can't
keeping count away. Here. I have one. Fisher has one. Minnis has one. No, you can have one.
Very good. Thank you. Katie, we're through for the day. You're going to have to come back next session, I'm afraid. Okay.
We're done.
We're done.
Oh, that was
Thank
exciting.
You. Thank you. Well, yeah, we got down to the...